I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, in the first half of our program, we will have the third of our conversations with the candidates to be Indiana's next governor. Fresh from appearing in this election season's first gubernatorial debate, Republican Mike Pence will step into the studio to take your questions. Then, in the second part of No Limits, we'll talk with IUPUI Law and Public Policy Professor Sheila Kennedy and Marion County Clerk Beth White about Indiana's Civics Health Index. You can join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. And you can shoot us a question or comment via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We've got a great show for you today, and we would like to welcome our new listeners in Northwest Indiana, those folks who tune in to Lakeshore Public Radio. It is good to have you as part of the circle. We're going to be talking today with Representative Mike Pence, the Republican candidate for governor, in the first half of the show. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking with Marion County Clerk Beth White and IUPUI Law and Public Policy Professor Sheila Kennedy about Indiana's Civics Health Index. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can shoot us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. While we are awaiting Mike Pence to arrive here in the studio, we will listen to just a little bit of last night's gubernatorial debate.
Thank you. I'm John Gregg. This election's about jobs, education, and bipartisanship. I bought the soda shop in Sanborn when I was 15 years old. I created my first job. I understand how to make a payroll. As former president of Vincennes University, I know all the opportunities in the world don't mean a thing unless we've got a well-educated and well-trained workforce. And I'm glad that I've always been able to get people to work together. And when I was Speaker of the House, every single bill that landed on the governor's desk had bipartisan support. So if you love this state like I do, I'd like to ask you to look beyond the party labels. And if you're tired of the gridlock in Washington, D.C., look beyond those labels. I'm the only candidate who's balanced Indiana's budget, improved funding for Indiana's schools, cut taxes for Hoosiers, and done so in a bipartisan way.
Thank you, Mr. Gregg. Mr. Bonham.
Thank you. And thank you to the Indiana Debate Commission for hosting this debate, to the Zionsville Performing Arts Center. It's an honor to be up here on stage. Thank you to all of you out in the audience and everyone watching at home. I appreciate you taking the time to hear what we have to say. I have, for my entire life, tried to empower the people around me. I grew up in Kokomo, Indiana. For the last 20 plus years, I've been living here in Indianapolis. Back in 91, I created my mentoring program with no city, state, federal funding, no government dollars, no grant dollars. I have been running my small businesses here for years. I have been putting people to work in situations that they have never been working in before. I have shown people how to get themselves out of trouble and back to work, to empower people. I want to stand up here as a change to what the status quo is. I am definitely that change.
Thank you, Mr. Bonham. Mike Pence, your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dennis. I want to thank the Indiana Debate Commission and my fellow competitors and all those that are here tonight in Zionsville and looking in from around the state of Indiana for this opportunity. I'm running for governor for really two reasons. Number one is I love this state. I'm a lifelong Hoosier. I grew up in Columbus, Indiana, in a large family, a lot of whom are here today, along with my wife, Karen, and two of her kids. I went down to Hanover College and studied American history, worked a few years, and then came up to Indianapolis to go to law school. Throughout that time, I've been the president of a state-based think tank. I started my own business, in which I had the opportunity to syndicate a broadcast around the state of Indiana, and had the chance to represent Indiana over the last 12 years in our nation's capital. The highest honor of my life would be serving the state as governor. But I'm running because I believe Indiana's on the verge of an era of growth and opportunity. And if we produce a plan, which I have in my roadmap for Indiana, I think we can take Indiana from good to great.
Thank you. You know, it's fitting. We're meeting at the Center for Performing Arts in Zionsville, which is on
the... Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the State House File, and your host. We are joined now by Representative Mike Pence, the Republican candidate for governor. Representative Pence, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, John. It's great to be on No Limits, and
it's good to,
see you again.
It's good to have you here. Our audience can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can shoot us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm going to start with the same question. We've had your two opponents on this show as well with the same question I started with them. Why do you want to be governor? What's the reason?
Well, thanks for the question.
Sure.
I appreciate it very much and appreciate the opportunity to be on. I'm running for governor for two reasons. One's a heart reason, the other's a head reason.
Mm-hmm.
The heart reason is I love this state, love everything about it. I was born and raised in southern Indiana. As I mentioned in that opening statement you just rolled, I've spent every day of my life growing up, living, working, raising a family, getting an education, and serving the people of Indiana. But for me, the opportunity to serve as governor of the state of Indiana would be the highest privilege of my life. And as that opportunity presented itself a few years ago, we felt very drawn to it on a deeply personal level, serving the people of this state as of first importance. But my other reason for running is I really do believe that Indiana is on the verge of a real era of growth. I think we've made extraordinary progress in the last 8 years. We've become the fiscal envy of the country. We've honestly balanced budgets over the last 8 years. We've cut taxes. We've capped property taxes. We've extended educational scholarships through vouchers to underprivileged kids more generously than any other state in the country. We've expanded economic freedom in the workplace, becoming a right-to-work state. And I think Indiana is poised for all of those reasons if we can stay on our present course and heading and continue to build on that foundation of fiscal responsibility and economic growth. I think we're poised to take our station as the leading state in the Midwest and one of the fastest-growing state economies in America. But it's going to take the right leadership. It's going to take the right ideas. And we've been trying to run a campaign that's introducing people to our brand of leadership and our ideas. And I don't know if I mentioned last night that I have a roadmap for Indiana, but
you did a few times.
We've laid it out.
Well, and I'd like to talk just a little bit, because you've alluded to the fact here that for the past 8 years, obviously, we've had a Republican governor, and this is in some ways one of the differences in your candidacy as opposed to the other two, is that it would be a continuation of one party's leadership in that office. So this is a little different. How would your governorship look different from Mitch Daniels's?
Well, from the very early part of this campaign, as we brought together a group that I call my idea factory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that roadmap for Indiana, which your listeners can go to at roadmapforindiana.com, you'll see a lot of work that's been done by over 300 men and women around the state of Indiana. And what I said to them were two words, to your point.
Yeah.
And I said, I want our candidacy and in any administration I would lead to be about continuity and aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
All of last year, we talked about building an even better Indiana,
mm-hmm.
Meaning that I think we've built a better Indiana. In the last 8 years, I think we've, as I said, I think in the practice of fiscal responsibility and the promotion of government reform, education reform, tax reform, workplace reform, we've set a brisk pace. But now I think our opportunity is to go from reform to results. Our opportunity is to produce the outcomes in good jobs and great schools that people are looking for. And our campaign is really about saying to people, yes, we have every intention of keeping Indiana on the course that we're on, but we want to aim even higher because with 250,000 people out of work, with 22% of our kids living in poverty, with 20,000 kids dropping out of school, John, it's clear we're not there yet. And so making sure that we continue to pursue the policies that are working and add to them the kind of common sense policies that will build on that momentum is the message of our campaign.
We're talking with the Republican candidate for governor, Mike Pence. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or shoot us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Mary who says, really, it's two questions. One, what public assets would you consider selling? Two, if you can't think of any right now, would you take a pledge to place a referendum on a ballot before doing so? She says it burns her up when politicians sell our roads and utilities and we have no say in it. So, first question, I guess, would be what public assets had he leased it, which is an important distinction.
Well, and let me be clear, I strongly supported the Major Moves project at the time and still. I mean, it literally put billions of dollars in our state treasury that allowed us to fund in real time projects that we've been talking about in this state for generations. I remember 20 years ago when I was starting to sit behind a microphone like you are now, about the time you and I first met, John. I mean, you know, connecting I-69 to Indianapolis was really just a dream that became a reality because we found a way to develop the kind of resources and financing that made that possible. And so, you know, what I would say to our listener that if you look at our roadmap for Indiana, we're not advocating privatization of any significant level. There's nothing in her the way she might view it that's on the chopping block to be sold. But I am committed to looking and having a continuous effort to look for greater efficiency in the use of taxpayer dollars. And if there are ways that we can make the delivery of services to taxpayers work harder and have be a more efficient use of our tax dollar, we're going to use that. But it's not been a major focus of ours. But I want to be clear that I did support major moves and still do and think that public and private partnerships of that nature ought to be a part of the discussion about Indiana's infrastructure future.
Are there other parts of state government that lend themselves to a privatized approach,
do you think? Well, there's lots of private contracting in state government today. And, you know, we found in our correction system, for instance, the delivery of services that's more efficiently operated through private contractors that are competitively bid. But again, I think looking at state government with an eye toward how do we most efficiently use that taxpayer dollar, and how do we provide the services that people rely on in the most efficient and effective way is my lodestar, and not a bias toward or against one particular model or privatization.
Well, what would be your priority then? The first thing that you would turn your attention to as governor, the thing, you know, that you would say, okay, I've been successful if I've accomplished this.
I just think the next governor of Indiana's got to make job creation job one. I mean, we have 255,000 people that are out of work. Those are just the folks that are telling us they're still looking. This economy is hurting in Indiana, just like it is all over the country. And we stated a very clear objective that our first goal would be increasing private sector employment with the goal of having more Hoosiers going to work than ever before in our state's history. Now, that's going to take some doing.
But and how would you do that?
I think you do that in a couple different ways. And first and foremost, Indiana is very attractive for business investment today because we have honestly balanced budgets. And I think making sure that we've got the largest budget surplus in our state's history, making sure that we keep those adequate reserves in the bank that preserves that top credit rating is job one. Our fiscal integrity is the first thing. The second thing, though, as I said in the debate last night, I think we ought to use the next dollar of that budget surplus to cut taxes across the board for every Hoosier in the city and on the farm. I'd like to see a 10% reduction in the income tax in this state. That'd put several hundred dollars in the pockets of Hoosiers. It'd put $500 million back into our economy over a two-year period of time. It would lower taxes on most small businesses in this state that file under the individual tax code, and it'd make us the lowest tax state in the Midwest and even more attractive for investment. I'm also calling for a moratorium on new regulations until we evaluate our entire regulatory code in this state to clear out the unnecessary or redundant regulations that are costing jobs in the Hoosier State. And then the third thing, and there are many more in the roadmap for Indiana, but I honestly believe that one of the most effective things that we could do to succeed in the marketplace is to succeed better in our schools and to work to have the best educated and the best skilled workforce in America. I think we got to make sure our kids are college ready. But I think, John, the time has come to make career and vocational education a priority in every high school in Indiana again. And give our kids who aren't ready to go right to school after high school, give them the background, the training, the industry certification opportunities to get those good-paying jobs that are available in Indiana today, even in this tough work environment, but are not being filled because the people in the workforce today don't have the background to fill them.
Indiana House Speaker Brian Bosma kind of fired a shot across all of the gubernatorial candidates' bows a few days ago when he said that the lawmakers needed to be convinced that your tax cut plans were sustainable. Have you talked with the Speaker since he made that statement?
I haven't, but frankly, I agree with the statement.
Yeah, well.
I really do. And and if people take a look at our proposal for a 10% across the board a tax cut, what we did was actually say first, what we want to do is use the first dollar of that budget surplus to increase our historic budget reserves from 10% up to 12.5%. We don't know what the future holds in this economy. It's still very shaky. And so I think the first thing we ought to do is strengthen our balance sheet. And the second thing is, what in my judgment, is to cut taxes across the board to get the economy rolling again. But if you look deep in that white paper that people can get to at roadmapforindiana.com, you'll find we took a very prudent approach to a two-year phase-in of that tax cut because, you know, what I read Speaker Bosma to have said is exactly what I would expect any fiscally responsible legislators to ask, and that is we've got to make sure that we sustain the fiscal health of the state even while we put more dollars in taxpayers' pockets through tax relief.
Greg, welcome to the program. Greg? Sorry, Greg, we've got a lot of feedback. Well, in terms of other priorities, the other thing that has been an innovation in terms of your campaign has been the call for a family impact statement on all Indiana legislation. Could you talk a little bit about what that is and, you know, how you would determine what the impact would be on a family?
You bet. Well, first, it really springs from the reality that we have 22% of our kids in Indiana living in poverty today. And when you look at the debate over poverty broadly, and especially childhood poverty, thinkers on the right and on the left across this country, from the Brookings Institution to the Heritage Foundation, are in broad agreement that the more kids that are growing up in two-parent intact families, the better. You're 85% less likely to live in poverty, grow up in poverty in a two-parent home. That's an extraordinary number, and it's part of a broad consensus that's emerged in this area around the country. And again, for me, this is really about simply saying, is there a way in Indiana that we can do two things? Number one is we propose that Indiana would be the first state in the country to host an annual conference on marriage, that we would bring together the best voices from a broad spectrum, that we would examine best practices, that we would hear from private and faith-based organizations and philanthropic groups and social scientists and say, how can we encourage more young people to get married, to stay married, and to wait to have kids till after they're married, and examining how we might in public ways, but more importantly, in private ways, encourage that institution as a means of getting at the question of childhood poverty. The other proposal we had was simply to say, with regard to new regulations in Indiana, where we have environmental impact statements, mm-hmm. where we want to make sure that that new regulations don't inadvertently work against various areas in our economy, that we would say that we would just simply add two-parent households to that, that we would say two-parent married families. We want to make sure that there's nothing in new regulations that inadvertently makes it more difficult for people to get married, to stay married, or to have kids when they're married. And again, this is really an effort on our part to affirm an institution that we believe is ultimately in the best interest of our kids in reducing childhood poverty in Indiana.
We've been talking with Representative Mike Pence, Republican candidate for governor. Thank you for spending this time with us. And I've said to each of your opponents, good luck. We wish you well. Hope you will come back. We're going to be talking in our next segment with Marion County Clerk Beth White and IUPUI Law and Public Policy Professor Sheila Kennedy about Indiana's Civics Health Index. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking in the second half of this program about Indiana's Civics Health Index with IUPUI Law and Public Policy Professor Sheila Kennedy. That is a mouthful. I almost run out of air. Sheila, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John.
It's good to have you here. And Marion County Clerk Beth White. That one's much easier to
get
through.
It is.
Beth, good to have you.
It's good to be here.
Good to have you here.
Everyone's easier than I am.
And I probably ought to do a quick disclosure. Sheila and I have a piece of biography in common. We were both former executive directors of what was then the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, now the ACLU of Indiana. Well, and we just finished talking with the Republican candidate for mm-hmm. governor, Representative Mike Pence. Thank him for joining us. I'd like to start first with a quick definition of what the Indiana Civics Health Index is. Sheila, I'll start with you.
Okay, well, the Civics Health Index is it was the Indiana version of a survey done nationwide that measured certain indicators that were determined to be connected to civic health, a percentage of people who voted, percentage of people who participated in other forms of democratic deliberation, democratic activism. It's a little bit different from the focus on civic literacy that I'm working on now and hope to be able to do some PR for today. But it is a quick and dirty, if you will, indicator of how engaged in the civic process the citizens of Indiana are. And Beth probably knows more about it than
well,
I do.
Well, and I'll throw that the next question then to Beth.
Well, it is. It's a snapshot. It's not a prescription for what to do, and it's not a discussion about how we got to where we are. It's just merely a set of indicators. And it's broader than voting, but what I care a lot about are the voting. There are things like how many religious institutions, the giving to charity, those sorts of things. But it was an evaluation, a yardstick. And by the way, we're not doing very well. The Civics Health of Indiana, I am here to report, unfortunately, is bad. We ranked 48th in voter turnout, 48th of the 50 states. Oh. We ranked 43rd in voter registration, that being those people who are eligible to register to vote, who actually do.
So we had some fall off even from the number who registered.
That's right. 43 out of 50 states. So it's pretty bad. And I applaud Sheila and others for trying to figure out what our next steps are, which is doing something about it. And I've been working on that myself as well.
Well, let's talk about in some of the other categories that we were talking about. A, do we think, you say this is a snapshot, and I'll toss this one to Sheila first. Do you think that the measuring sticks here are appropriate ones? Are they truly revealing? Are there others that you would include? Or
I think for what they were trying to measure, the questions and attitudes were absolutely appropriate. As Beth says, you know, this, we take this snapshot and we say, okay, how engaged in the process are our citizens? We get a result, in this case, not a very exciting result, or exciting the very wrong way. The next question becomes the kind of question that academics get involved in, which is, how did we get here? What are the indicators of the kinds of participation that we're trying to encourage? Right now, as Beth pointed out, we've just established, and I mean just, July 1st was our start date, a Center on Civic Literacy at IUPUI. And that is different from the kinds of civic engagement that the snapshot was about. We're honing in on one little piece of that, which is, what do Americans know about their government? And we will be asking, how does what they know relate to how they behave, which is the snapshot that we got. But just to give you something to cry about at night, John.
I don't need anything more.
Because goodness
thank
knows
you.
I need
no,
that.
This is, I mean, my husband's used to, this is right before I start drinking. 36% of Americans know that we have three branches of government. We are talking about, there's a lot of survey information out there about how little we know. There's a lot less about the causes and consequences of that, and that's what we're going to be doing. But I think my favorite statistic, if you want to make, I mean, this is hardly a favorite, but there was one thing that asked students who the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was, and 94% knew. I didn't. I was in the other 6%. But that, and how many of those same teenagers knew who the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court was, and it was 2%. I mean, I could go through an entire list of very depressing statistics like that. The one thing we absolutely know is that we don't know much, and our concern at the center is when we're not speaking the same language. And John, you know this from your years at the ACLU. I mean, if you and I sit down and we disagree about whether the Establishment Clause ought to apply here or not, fine, we disagree.
First, you got to know what the Establishment Clause is.
Yeah, but when you don't know what the Establishment Clause is, that's a problem. If I say bloggers ought to be covered under the free press provisions of the First Amendment, and you say, no, I don't think they should, fine. That's the kind of argument that is appropriate to our system. But if you say, what's the First Amendment or what's freedom of the press, that's a problem. So that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, and let me pull Beth in, and I'd also like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. So just to not leave anyone hanging here with Sheila's reference point, how is it that 94% of the American public knows who Will Smith is and only 2% knows who John Roberts is?
Well,
how do we get here?
Well, you know, I think that that's a topic for broader than we have time for this afternoon. What I can tell you in my work, and I've been doing kind of my own piece of this, I'm only one, but I am one, and what can I do, right? So what I've been doing is going into the high schools and doing a voting curriculum. We call it Why Vote or Youth Vote. It's gotten an award from the Association of Counties. We just do a basic civics curriculum, voting. Here's how we vote. Here's what we vote. Whole ballot, feed it through the machine. We talk about branches of government. We talk about legislative, executive, term limits, no term limits, those differences. And I'm trying to do what I can. We've registered thousands of students this way. We've done the curriculum to thousands and thousands of students in Marion County, and you know, so far so good. You know, I think I'm trying, and I think that's really critical for me to get them involved in the electoral process, because that's the work that I do. But they'll have side benefits too.
Pat, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Your question, please.
I agree with what your speakers are saying, but it ties into your last speaker, who is the candidate for governor, and people don't know how to stay involved in the electoral process when you have somebody like Mike Pence talking about setting a summit on marriage. That's not his business. And if nobody holds him accountable for that, people think that that's what it's all about. And the important parts of civic engagement is lost. I mean, you didn't call him into account about that.
You're speaking to me?
Yes.
Okay, well, and in part, that's the framework of this show. It is to draw people out and get their views so that you can make up your mind. I think there are enough people who do the kind of advocacy journalism and other outlets where they argue with their guests, and that's consciously something we're not trying to do. I'm trying to get the views of the guests out there so that you can make up your own mind about them.
Well, it turns people off.
Well, and I apologize for that. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll allow Sheila Kennedy to respond.
You know, actually, what you're saying is exactly the point of our center and our concern, which is accountability. You know, we can't hold our public officials accountable unless we know what it is they're supposed to be doing. And if that gets back to the very early premises of the country and what government's supposed to do and what is supposed to be left to the private sector. And, you know, if we don't, I get mad because people think that every 4 years we elect a monarch who's going to wave a wand and magically enforce all the promises, if they really intend to do that anyway. But that's not the way our system works. We have something called checks and balances, which is an outgrowth of three branches of government. So knowing what government is supposed to do, and as you point out, very importantly, what government is not supposed to do, is a huge part of keeping government accountable. And if citizens don't know those things, then they can't enforce accountability.
Well, that whole notion of where the limits of government should be, too, is one of those subjects that we've debated now for more than 225 years.
Exactly.
That, you know, one of the arguments, and I know that one of Representative Pence's opponents, former House Speaker John Gregg, has referred to the family impact statement as social engineering. Government, to some degree, always engages in social engineering. Question is, you know, whether it is appropriate or constitutional. I'll toss that one back to Sheila, and then we'll find a way for Beth to jump in here.
Fine.
Sheila is hogging the microphone, and I feel bad about that because Beth actually gets stuff done. Mm-hmm. John, you're exactly right. I mean, but again, my students come in, even my graduate students, and they don't understand that the Bill of Rights, to give you an example, is a list of things that government can't do. They come in thinking that anything government decides to do is appropriate for government to do. And it's one thing to have an argument, as the candidates for governor are, an appropriate argument over whether this particular approach that Pence is providing is appropriate or not. But that's the issue that ought to be under investigation, no candidate should be able to just throw something out there and say, well, we're going to do X, without having a discussion about whether X is something that government ought to do in the first place.
Well, to some degree here, to be fair to Representative Pence, he is presenting it to the electorate. He's done
Precisely.
It before the vote right now,
so that
the voters can make up their own mind. Clearly, with Pat, it is a policy that she does not find appropriate and is going to probably vote accordingly, I would guess. Others do. Beth,
can I jump
real
in
quickly? Yeah, we've got about 20 seconds.
You said my famous word, which is vote.
Yeah.
For me, what is important about all this is the relationship between people voting and the people they elect. And when we have fewer than 50% of the people participating, even fewer than that, then we've got a problem.
We are talking about Indiana's Civics Health Index here on No Limits with our guests, Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, law and public policy professor Sheila Kennedy. I'm going to get that right one of these times. And Marion County Clerk Beth White. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking in this segment of the show about Indiana's Civics Health Index with IUPUI Law and Public Policy Professor Sheila Kennedy. See, that gets easier with practice. And Marion County Clerk Beth White. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can also send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, we've established here that Indiana's civics health numbers do not look good.
Right. On life support is what
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty
so,
bad.
and we've talked a little bit about how we got here. Let's turn the corner now. What do we do about it? Beth White, I'll start with you.
Well, in my world, which is the world of voting, and you know, voting has started for this election, I think what we do about it is make our law reflect our goals, which is to make it possible for people to vote. And I think that, unfortunately, Indiana has been on the shameful vanguard of efforts that are not helpful, that we have done things specifically in the last 5 or 6 years,
such as
the voter ID law, such as a 30-day registration period, which is the longest in the country, by the way. Even California is going to same-day registration after this election. We have 30 days where we cut off registration. It is very hard for a lot of people, and I interact with those voters literally every day. In person, I have this conversation with people about who don't have the ID they need, who have just moved, and some lady came up today and said, I just moved here last week. I want to register to vote. Well, ma'am, you missed the deadline by 2 days. So I'm sorry, but it's not possible for you to register to vote. So these are the things I think we ought to focus on and think about, expanding early voting opportunities in a flexible way. In 2008, we had two satellite sites that were wildly popular. 72,000 people voted early. It was terrific in every way, and we have to have a unanimous vote of the Republican of the election board, which requires both political parties to agree. We can't get an agreement because the Republican Party will not agree. Marion County voters will not have flexible options for early voting, although the voters in Lake County and Johnson County and Boone County have flexible options. So I'll ask Sheila whether she thinks that's an equal protection problem, and I don't know, put her on the spot.
We'll get there in a second, but it sounds like just in going through those counties, it sounds like it's easier to get these things if you're not in a competitive county where the parties are balanced, which is not the way one would think we would want it. Is that fair, Beth?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think what is true is that in places, Lake County, you know, being example, they just work it out. They work it out. There are Republicans on their election board, even though they're an overwhelming Democrat county, and they work it out. They say, well, okay, where do you think they ought to be, and where do we think we ought to be, and we'll have enough of them so that we minister to everyone's concerns. We can't get that done in Marion County for reasons that are unclear to me. But what I do know is the voters are the ones who were hurt by that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I also would like to ask and broaden first the question Beth posed to Sheila. Is there an equal protection problem? And we probably also ought to explain what an equal protection problem is.
Yeah. Equal protection of the law basically means that you treat similarly situated folks similarly. And I go through, you know, 6 hours of explanation in a non-law class about that. So that's all I can do here. But I think there may well be an equal protection argument to be made. I also want to piggyback on something Beth said, because it, you know, people are talking about, oh, you've got to have voter ID because there's going to be voter fraud. Well, there's ample evidence that there is very, very, I mean, minuscule voter fraud in the sense of people coming to the polls and pretending to be someone they're not. It, to the extent that voter fraud has been documented, it's almost never in-person voting. It's in the process of absentee ballots, which are not touched by the voter ID mandate at all. And I, you know, it's a good thing not to read letters to the editor a lot of the time, because, you know, screaming hysterically at the newspaper doesn't really do you much good. But there was a letter a few weeks ago.
Can be therapeutic for some people.
Well, that is true. Yeah. I think my husband has begun cowering behind the couch. But, you know, there was a letter from somebody who said, well, without voter ID, you could vote in two states. I hate to tell that person, but you can vote in two states as long as you've got the only thing the voter ID does is say, yes, I'm who I say I am. It doesn't say where you live. It does certainly not deter somebody who is really intent on voting on two states.
We are talking about Indiana's Civics Health Index here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Certainly. Your question, please.
All right. I'm a high school teacher here in Indianapolis, and in reference to Representative Pence's statement regarding marriage and poverty, I was a little bothered by the caller that challenged that as the responsibility of government, because the fact is that when children are faced with poverty, they're not focused on what the law says as a right or even really understanding anything about the electoral process. So I wanted your commentators to respond to what is the actual responsibility of politicians. You know, is it effective, or is it simply to teach people what the law says?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Jason. We'll try to get an answer for you. Well, I'll start first with Beth White on that one.
Mm. Well, thanks.
Yeah, well, you get the easy one.
Well, yeah, I'd like to thank the caller for the hard work that he does. You know, I do this curriculum in the high schools, and I come home absolutely exhausted. I don't know how teachers do it day after day. I think that we have to recognize that in education in particular, some people come to school ready to learn and some people don't. And that is a reality that we face, and that the government has a responsibility to do something about that. Now, is that giving everyone a marriage license and saying, you know, go forth and good luck? Well, I think that the social scientists need to answer that question. But I think that there are more direct and important things that we can do, including nutrition, health care for children, educational opportunities and access to that in every place, and making sure their parents can take care of themselves. I think those are some of the things we ought to start with. And just the notion of making sure everyone's married seems to me not to be the solution.
And notice, listeners, I didn't challenge Beth on her assertion.
That's right. Thank you.
Well, because Sheila, she's right. No, Beth is absolutely right. And so is your caller. I mean, is childhood poverty and coming to school unready to learn with extra barriers a government issue? Of course it is. Is deciding that certain kinds of parents and certain kinds of families are better, and that eventually, through some magic, that will produce kids who come to school well-fed, is a bit of a stretch. So as I tell my students, you know, in the United States, we are a very bipolar country. I mean, it's either good or bad. It's right or wrong. I try to tell my students that the answer to an awful lot of questions may not be very satisfying, but often it depends, and it's more complicated than that. And so deciding or noting the fact that we have a problem with childhood poverty, no problem saying that is, in my view at least, a government an appropriate thing for government to do. But as Beth points out, there, if you are basing what programs you are proposing on sound evidence of what works, what doesn't have unanticipated negative consequences, that is where government, and even if you were able to say, okay, we're going to make everybody who stay married to the heterosexual partner that they first married, there is no evidence that would wipe out childhood poverty. But even if there were, that exceeds government's role. That kind of a fix, if you will, is beyond the legal, constitutional jurisdiction of the government. But what government can do is exactly the kinds of things that Beth is talking about. Make sure those kids get fed if they come to school hungry. Take care to provide the other kinds of social services that may be necessary to assist families in crisis. Those are the kinds of interventions that are within our constitutional culture and also have been demonstrated to be effective.
We are talking about Indiana's Civics Health Index here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to actually jump back to Jason's question here, which was the premise really of education here, because I would think at least part of where we were talking about the what other steps should we do, other than Beth's made a case, obviously, for changing the voting laws and
yes,
easing some of the restrictions.
Yes.
In terms of, but that in and of itself may not solve the problem of why, you know, 47 times as many people know who Will Smith is as who's John Roberts. See, I do know how to do math.
Good.
In a hurry. So what steps, Sheila Kennedy, should we take to better prepare people to exercise those rights that they have?
That is exactly the kind of research question that our new center is going to focus on. There have been efforts periodically to improve civics education in the schools. And initially, I would say that since we're in this, my God, if you're teaching it, you have to test for it. I mean, a lot of the problem with current lack of civics education in the schools is attributable to the fact that we don't test for that. We're testing for math and English, and people teach to the test. So there are some early indications of ways we might address those issues. But I think what we need is a broader effort, and we will see if the research bears me out. But I don't think telling the schools this is all your problem and mm-hmm. and it's your you have to turn out these kids. Yes, we do need to take a very close look to see why prior efforts to improve and then it falls off. So we're looking at that. But I think there's a broader array of interventions that we should be undertaking, and Beth's is an excellent example of that. Having public officials go into the schools and talk about their little piece of the big puzzle is hugely important. Kids who actually see an elected official and know you don't have horns or anything,
no.
you know, and
no.
and hear these things. I mean, but it's not something we can just say, well, the schools need to do a better job. We all need to do a better job. And what we're going to look at in the research we're doing is what are those kinds of interventions? What can we do to make people – I have a project coming up that sometime I'll ask you to ask me back and I'll talk about. But Jackie Needus, who's head of the library here in Marion County, suggested that we go to the sports bars and have all those trivia contests include some civic literacy questions. You know? I mean, I don't, whatever. But
well, and admittedly, and I hear the point that we shouldn't just dump this all on the schools. I do wonder if in some ways the problem isn't compounded for the schools or the challenge, because they do try to provide civics education. The
sure.
fact that, frankly, we can't arrive at any sort of consensus right now, we're in the middle of a pretty profound debate about what the Constitution means, what the First Amendment means, what other parts of the Bill of Rights means, and that's really not something that's new. We've had those discussions for 223 years now. Does that make the task more difficult? Obviously, Mike Pence views the Constitution differently from what Rupert Boneham does.
Yes, Mike and I have had many discussions in the past about that. You're right. I mean, we have had this ongoing debate about what do we mean by original intent, all of that sort of thing. And some of those discussions are really healthy. Right now, though, we are in the middle, as you alluded to, of a really big effort to sort of a revisionist history effort. The ability of people like David Barton, for example, to just make up stuff and write books about it is
Please explain who David Barton is.
Okay, he's a faux historian whose last book was withdrawn by his publisher, actually. Mm-hmm. But be that as it may, there are lots of faux historians out there. But if people are well educated on the basic stuff, they're less likely to fall for those kinds of demagogues who are trying to rewrite the Constitution to make particular points on any side of the spectrum. Let me just give you one example. I had a student, and I introduced original intent by saying, so, hey, what do you think James Madison thought about porn on the Internet? Mm-hmm. And usually the students laugh and say, well, I guess James Madison probably didn't think much about porn on the Internet. And then we talk about what he thought about free expression and how that might apply and that sort of thing. I asked that to a junior in college with a decent grade point average, and she looked at me and said, who's James Madison? That's my problem. I don't care if somebody disagrees with me about the proper interpretation of the First Amendment or any amendment. I care that they've read it, that they know who James Madison is, that they know what the Enlightenment was and how it changed the Puritan understanding of liberty. I mean, just a basic understanding of American history and a what used to be a very basic understanding of the Constitution.
Well, and I guess, Beth White, I'll ask real quickly, in terms of what Sheila's saying here, is that sort of the goal that we should aspire to, is preparing people so that they can have those kinds of informed arguments?
I think so, and I think that it's just, we got to go back to basics. I think exactly what Sheila said. People need to understand their role, and that is to vote, to know that they elect people who make decisions. We have great conversations with the students about school board. They say, I hate my superintendent, okay? And I was like, well, okay, let's talk about that. Who hires your superintendent? Well, we don't know. Well, your school board. How do they get their jobs? Well,
who
you elect them, right?
Department.
I mean, and the students don't even know that. And there is a moment of awareness where they say, oh, well, I could have some influence. I can elect a school board who does or does not like the superintendent. I have some power here. And that has nothing to do with interpretation of the Constitution. No. That just has to do with an understanding of what role they can play. And that's what I'm trying to do.
We've got about 45 seconds left, so I'm going to ask each of you real quickly, what is one common sense kind of practical thing we could do to improve the level of civics education in this state? Beth, I'll stay with you.
Reform election laws. Make it easier to register. Make it easier to vote. We have expanded flexible options.
And in about 25 seconds, Sheila.
Beef up citizenship education.
In what ways?
In the schools and outside the schools. Make it an important thing to know about your own government, who elects who, how it works, what the various, where to go if you have a beef.
And if nothing else, we should be glad that at least the people who were listening to this program now know who the Chief Justice of the United States is.
And who James Madison is.
And James Madison
is. And I hope she doesn't ask me, because I think I know, but I go to law school, so we'll see.
John Roberts, of course, is from Elkhart, Indiana.
Yeah,
he is a native Hoosier, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, I would like to thank Sheila Kennedy, who is a law and public policy professor at IUPUI, and Marion County Clerk Beth White for joining us. It's a pleasure having both of you here. Also like to thank Representative Mike Pence for joining us. We will be back next week when we're going to be talking about turmoil in the arts community. Thank you for joining us on IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.